Gargamuni sent his family priest. Vasudeva sent his family priest Gargamuni to perform the name giving ceremony. His son. When Nanda Maharaj came to Mathura to take taxes, Vasudeva was inquiring about his son Balaram and Nanda's son Krishna in such a way as to ascertain whether Vasudeva was aware, whether Nanda was aware that Krishna was actually Vasudeva's son. And in the dialogue, Vasudeva detected that Nanda had no knowledge that Krishna was Vasudeva's son. Vasudeva was relieved at this, fearing that if the Brijavasis knew that Krishna was actually the son of Vasudeva, and comes to extend his efforts to kill the child. So he was relieved at that. Nevertheless, at the end of their very friendly, warm meeting, which great heartfelt affection for each other was expressed. Their devotion to Krishna and consequent love and affection for one another. Vasudeva advised Nanda Maharaj, you better return quickly to Braj. There could be some calamities. But on the way back, Nanda Maharaj was thinking, what did he mean by that? Certainly his words are true. I must be very diligent. And then as he's returning back, he smelled this very sweet aroma, which was the burning body of Bhutana, which demonstrates a wonderful point that however ugly or grotesque, ghastly something may be, like my own heart, when it's touched by Krishna, it becomes sweet and pure. Fragrant, because Krishna means all attractive, and his effect makes everything else all attractive. His purifying influence draws out the undesirable, ghastly, ugly anartas and aparad, and leaves the pure soul, who, in the case of Putana, was elevated to the position of nursemaid to Mother Yashoda, because Krishna took that little bit of good. She approached me as a mother, and he extricated all the evil motives and intentions behind that disguise. So, further being relieved that the Brijavasis didn't know that Krishna was Vasudev's son. Vasudev sent his family priest, Gargamuni, to perform the name-giving ceremony. Nevertheless, Nanda Maharaj was uneasy about this, as was Vasudev, that if we perform this purificatory rite publicly, Kamsa may come to know of it, and he'll be suspicious. Why is Gargamuni, the priest of the Jadu dynasty, performing this ceremony for the son of Nanda Maharaj? So he said, this is very hazardous. Nanda said, we can do it in the cowshed, secretly. So, in that meeting, Gargamuni said, your son Krishna appears as an incarnation in every millennium. In the past, he assumed different colors, white, red, and yellow. And now he has appeared in Shyam complexion. Because your son appeared as the son of Vasudev, he is sometimes called Vasudev. So here, Vasudev actually revealed the truth that Krishna is the son of Vasudev. But is Krishna the son of Vasudev? Vasudev and Devaki, as we discussed briefly last night, but didn't go into much depth, were previously Krishna and Sutapa, who had a desire for the Lord to be their son, for which purpose they performed severe tapasya for 12,000 celestial years, which is such a vast duration of time. One day on this planet being, or one day in the heavenly planets being 6 months on Earth. Because they were sadhana siddhas. The question came up in Chaitanya Charitamrita, well, if Vasudeva Devaki performed that much tapasya to have a plenary portion of Krishna as their son, what did Nanda Yashoda do? And the answer is they didn't do anything. They're eternally the father or mother of Vrajendanandana Krishna. But Vasudeva Devaki, being the Amsas of Nanda Yashoda, whereas Nanda Yashoda Nitya Siddhas, Vasudeva and Devaki are, they're Amsas, who are half Aishwarya and half Madhurya in their love for Krishna. And acting as sadhana siddhas, they had to perform this tapasya. And when the Lord appeared and asked them what is the object of their penance, they said, we want a son like you. He said, there's no one like me. So I'll have to become your son. Not once, not twice, but three times. So then as Kashyapa and Aditi, they gave birth to Vamana. As Vasudeva and Devaki, they gave birth to Krishna. And he revealed himself first, hovering above the ground in his forearm form, holding conch club, disc lotus, and wearing crown helmet. His Aishwarya feature. Just to testify to them that, yes, I, the Lord, have come. And then out of fear of Kamsa, he said, please hide yourself. So he became a little baby. Sanatana Goswami reveals an interesting fact later in Bhagavatam, which occurred at this time. Then when Krishna told Vasudev to take him across Jamuna, Mother Devaki was thinking, such a long journey, he'll get hungry. So she breastfed him just for an instant before. So, you know, after 12,000 celestial years of intense tapasya, the Lord finally appears And as Vishnu, looking down upon them with great feeling for all they've been through, having seen their six sons slaughtered brutally before their very eyes. Can you imagine? Not once or twice, but six times, Devaki's newborn son, shining effulgently, smashed, pulverized on the rocks before her very eyes by her own brother. How incredibly traumatic. I can't imagine. So the Lord was looking down at them with great feeling and empathy for all the ordeal they've been through. And then he tells Vasudeva, take me to Nanda's house. After appearing after millenniums of tapasya and sadhana and discipline and prayer, the first thing he does is he leads them. So, we discussed last night, we could go a little bit deeper because I was seeing so many Americans in the audience, I was afraid to delve too deeply into the wonders of Krishna Lila. But since whatever Americans are present today are dedicated to Krishna consciousness and Srila Prabhupada's mission, we can appreciate a little more deeply the six sons, what they represent, what Kamsa. Not to get too much into symbology, because Srila Prabhupada really de-emphasized symbology in the early days, because the hippies he was preaching to were too likely to take Krishna Lila as symbolic. Krishna Lila is not symbolic, it's absolute truth. But absolute truth is the source of symbology. You know, people who don't have Krishna consciousness, they utilize symbology to try to make some sense out of existence. And it comes through in mythology and religion and folklore and so many ways. Visions, images, dreams. But the source, the pure, perfect source of all symbology is Krishna Lila. It's not symbolic, it's absolute. But the absolute contains symbology. And the scriptures are full of symbology. And it's important because that is a language that speaks to all souls at all times, from all races and all ethnic origins and all religions, on whatever level of spiritual advancement they may be. And even our acharyas, Srila Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur, Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur, heavily expressed the symbolic aspect of Krishna's Lila. So if we're rooted firmly in Srila Prabhupada's emphasis that Krishna Lila is not symbolic, it's absolute truth, and that absolute truth is rich in symbology, then we can appreciate the symbology without the potential hazards it might cause in our minimizing the absolute nature of Krishna's appearance and Lila. So, Sridhar Swami explains that the six sons are the categorical archetypes, Kam, Krodha, Lobha, Moha, Mada, Matsarya. Srila Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur looks at it from another dimension. The six sons of Devaki are the objects of the senses, sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, and thought, because the mind is the sixth sense. And it's very important to understand Krishna Lila in terms of our own sadhana, or we could say it the other way, our own sadhana in terms of Krishna Lila. Because Krishna consciousness means we're preparing for the appearance of Krishna in our hearts. And this is the microcosm of the macrocosmic historic, not exactly historic event, an absolute truth manifesting within the realm of historic context. They're related. And the more we understand the relation of how Krishna appears, how he kills the demons, has a counterpart within our own hearts. He kills the anarthas as he's preparing to take birth in our infant Krishna consciousness. And as it grows and becomes stronger, he will continue empowering us to overcome obstacles on the path to bhakti. So, the six sons, of course, historically, they were originally the sons of Marici, the collective mind of the universe. They committed an offense when they laughed at Lord Brahma. Even though what he was doing was wrong, it was a serious breach of etiquette to laugh disrespectfully. Because Brahma was being used by Krishna to demonstrate a lesson that however powerful, exalted, and devotional one may be as Brahma, the objects of the senses are so powerful that without Krishna's protection and empowerment, we cannot control ourselves. So Krishna was using Brahma to demonstrate that point for the benefit of all of us. And the six sons of Marici laughed at Brahma, for which they were cursed by the sages to take birth as the grandsons of Hiranyakashipu. And in that birth, they followed in the footsteps of their grandfather by taking shelter of Brahma, seeking immortality. And when their father, Kalanimi, heard of this, and their grandfather, Hiranyakashipu, he was enraged. "I am controlling everyone in the universe," Hiranyakashipu said, "and you, my six grandsons, are going to my servants for shelter. This is offensive to the head of the demons. Therefore, I curse you. In your next birth, you will be killed by your own father." So the next birth, they were born of Devaki, to be killed by Kamsa. So understand the context in terms of sadhana. As we practice sadhana, our senses become purified. And as our consciousness is uplifted from the dull darkness of ignorance into the bewildering fires and passions of Tamagun, and proceeds into the tranquil, clear perception of Satugun with the deeper sense of happiness and satisfaction inherent to that mode, there's actually a great danger that the material world may appear more alluring than before. With refined sense perception, we can detect these subtle embellishments and refined aspects of the wonders of material nature. And that may lure us into the misconception that now, as we're advancing, we can enjoy more than before, to protect us from this misconception which could deviate us from the path of bhakti. Krishna arranges for the rise of another element into the position of power. In the realm of bhakti, his name is Kamsa. Very interesting how Ugrasena, who was cousin to Parjanya Maharaj. Ugrasen was born of Kshatriya mother, so he was given rule over Mathura. Parjanya Maharaj was born of a Vaishya mother, so he was given rule over the Vaishya community of Braj. Ugrasena had such a saintly son, Surasena, whereas Parjanya Maharaj had, you know, the five sons headed by Upananda. In the middle was Nanda Maharaj. Pure devotees of the highest caliber. How would Ugrasena have such a hideous demoniac Rakshasa leader for a son? You know the story? Ugrasena's wife was very beautiful and young. And one spring morning she was playing in the garden. And this Asura flying over in his airplane was captivated by her beauty. And he made a landing. And the Rakshasas are very expert in deception. He assumed a form that looked so much like Ugrasena that when he approached the girl in the garden, she was thinking, oh, my husband has come. And she surrendered to his will. Later found out it was not her husband, and as a result, Kamsa was born. Kamsa represents fear. His very name struck fear in the hearts of the demigods. Kamsa was also very fearful. He was very insecure. And therefore, he married the two daughters of Jarasandha to have powerful military might to protect him in his ambitions and support him. Then he only had one fear left. This Vasudeva is such an influential political figure that if anybody could lead an uprising against me, it would be him. So Kamsa was instrumental in the marriage of Vasudeva to his cousin sister, Devaki. And he showed his support and encouragement by driving the chariot, thinking that if Vasudeva marries my sister, then everyone will support me. I'll have the support of Jarasandha and his vast armies. I'll have the support of Vasudeva, who's so influential in Mathura. But then when he heard the voice from the sky, when he's acting as such a gentleman with such affection for his sister, in an instant he's ready to behead her. And Vasudeva is pleading, it doesn't look very good for your character if you behead your sister at the time of her marriage in a public procession. And still he couldn't alter his motive and incentive and plan. So then he had to make the arrangement that I'll hand over all my children. So Kamsa represents fear in the kingdom of Mathura. And he's an crucial personality in the kingdom of our hearts. Because if we think that, oh, motive goodness, peaceful, happiness, senses are purified, they can perceive to much deeper, richer extent the subtle refinements and wonders of material nature, we might become distracted from the path. And therefore, Kamsa arises to power so that we understand the actual unmasked hideous nature of material existence. It's fearful to the soul because it tries to take us away from Krishna. And with that understanding, personified by Kamsa, what do we do with our purified senses? Apply them more feelingly in the service of the Lord, for the pleasure of the Lord. So in the service of the Lord, the senses become purified even beyond the level of Satyagun and attain the stage of Shuddhisattva. And on that stage, we can actually perceive what the material senses cannot apprehend, which is the transcendental nature of the Lord's birth, pastimes, and message, which, according to the Lord's own promise in Bhagavad Gita, awards that we never have to take birth again. If we understand the divine nature of his appearance, pastimes, and teachings, we never have to take birth again in this material world. But this does not mean some theoretical or philosophical understanding. It means realization within the heart, which takes humility. For the philosophical understanding to be assimilated by the soul. Otherwise, it just remains theoretical. If we do not go through Mahaprabhu's teachings, which emphasize Trinadabhisunichena, Todorabhisishnana, Amanita Amanadena, Kirtaniya Sadari. So, as Srila Prabhupada read the words of his Gurudev on that record album, following Srila Prabhupada singing with such devotion and feeling, Brahma Samhita, and then he began to speak, the materialistic demeanor cannot possibly stretch to the transcendental autocrat who is forever inviting all conditioned souls to associate with him eternally in loving service mode. The transcendental autocrat, the supreme being who possesses by his inherent right all powers. And what is he doing? He's crawling on the ground, following the ankle bells of some Madhati who he thinks is his mother. And when he sees that that's not my Mata, he scampers back in fear, looking for the shelter of Mother Jashoda. In this way, the transcendental autocrat is forever inviting us. When he's a little older, and as game, he and Balaram would grab the tails of the calves, who would become frightened and run, and they would slide through the manure of Braj. And that manure of the Chintamani cows mixed with the dust of Chintamani would make them very beautiful and very happy. And the gopis and gopas watched in wonder as the transcendental autocrat, who possesses all powers by his inherent right, is attracting and inviting us to associate with him. And of course, when they got a little older, Krishna became very uncontrolled in his passions to steal butter. And whenever he got caught, and the householder would say, you were a thief. Krishna would say, I'm not a thief. You're a thief. And you get angry. The transcendental autocrat. And then, of course, as he grew up, he's stealing everything. Stealing the innocent protection of the gopis, stealing the minds of his devotees, stealing away all their sinful reactions, all their miseries. He's a thief. The transcendental autocrat. So, Anyway, after the six sons of Devaki are kicked out, Balaram appears. It's by Balaram's influence, because Balaram is the original guru. By his influence, Anartas are removed. So when they are removed by his influence, then he himself appears in the heart of Devaki. And after performing his service of manifesting the Dhamma with all paraphernalia for the pleasure and service of Krishna, he's transferred to Gokul. So when Rohini suddenly became pregnant, she herself was shocked because her husband was in prison in Mathura. She was smuggled out to Braj. And then how did she become pregnant? She didn't know herself. Nanda Maharaj's priest, he explained the situation. That Devaki's embryo was transferred. And everyone accepted that. They kept it confidential that it didn't get back to Mathura and reach the ears of Kamsa. So, then, we were discussing a little last night, superficially. Let me appreciate a little more today how when Nanda was married to Yashoda, the Brijavasis were so elated. But actually, Upananda was the eldest of the sons of Barjanya Maharaj, so he was to be the king. But Upananda called an assembly. He was usually the one who would call assemblies. And he explained that, you know, my younger brother, Nanda, is so much more qualified than I. So I recommend that he be the king. And appropriate to my name, Upa, which means secondary, I'll be the secondary Nanda. I'll be like an advisor. I'll be his servant. And in Braj, everyone is so free of envy and ego that they just happily accepted the younger brother, Nanda, to be their king. And then he was married to a beautiful daughter of a neighboring village. And the Brijavasis were so elated. And the land was flourishing with butter and yogurt and just all gifts of bounty. But as time went on, year after year, and decade after decade, Nanda and Yashoda had no offspring. And all of Nanda's brothers had only daughters. So as time went on, the Brijavasis were feeling a little disheartened. What to speak of Nanda? They'd all into his old age, and like in his, you know, their 70s, they had no child. And what's the hope of having a baby when you're in your 70s? So it was like a dark cloud of gloom that was hovering over the ecstatic Brijavasis, that there's this one deficiency. But Nanda never gave up hope. Nanda means joy, the joy of devotional service. He was so exclusively Narayana Parayana, sold out to the will of the Lord. That's why he never performed any yagyas, right? He didn't have a child. He was just dependent on the will of the Lord. And then, when he confided in Mother Yashoda that, you know, I've had this desire for a son, but I feel deeply, and I see clearly, we do have a son playing in the courtyard, climbing in your lap, sucking your breast. It's like a dream, but this when I'm awake. I see these things. I experience and feel this reality. I've been praying for Lord Narayan for his son, but I see and feel we do have a son. Who is even more beautiful than Lord Narayan? How can this be? Who can this be? And Mother Jesuita said, "My dear, I was reluctant to tell you, but I had the same experience." So they're eternally the father and mother of Krishna. But in the spiritual world, there's no Janmashtami as we know it here. There's no birth of Lord Krishna. He's eternally present there. The material world is very wonderful because it acts as a mirror to reflect back to the spiritual world certain pastimes that cannot take place there, like the birth of Lord Krishna. And then when those Nityasiddhas come to this world, they have this sense that we don't have a child. But in another dimension, they feel that we do have a child, because there's many dimensions of absolute reality interplaying in the wonderful patterns of rasa which permeate Braj. So then they concluded we should, you know, perform this Dwadasi Vrata. After which, when Jashoda was massaging the lotus feet of Nanda Maharaj, and she fell into a slumber, she saw in a dream that in his meditation, the Lord had appeared and descended into his heart. From where he was transferred to her heart, from where he was transferred to her womb. And when she woke up, she woke her husband and said, "I had the same dream." And just then, her belly began to grow and her breast began to swell. And everyone saw that Nandarani is with child. And that dark cloud of gloom just dispelled. But when it was time for her to give birth, and she had her own separate room, the maternity ward, with a nurse to care for her, the nurse was gone on the night of the delivery, not understanding that that was the time. Of course, it was all under the arrangement of Yoga Maya for Vasudev to bring his child over and Jashoda to be just oblivious from the ordeal of having to deliver not one, but two children by herself, Krishna and Subhadra. So she was just delirious. When the nurse came in the morning, of course, it was when Vasudev came that, you know, he exchanged. And his child, Vasudev Krishna, merged into Nanda's son. He took the girl, who was raised by Kamsa to be slaughtered like the others, but she flew into the sky in a form, and he revealed her eight-arm form and told him, "You can't kill me. The child prophesies to kill you is already born. Just ahead of me, somewhere else. Now stop these atrocities, dear poor sister and brother-in-law." And she disappeared. So, you can wonder, you know, why such a gentleman as Vasudev would exchange his son with his cousin's daughter to be slaughtered. But this is all under the arrangement of Yoga Maya by that influence. Jashoda's nurse was not around on the night when she delivered, and then when, you know, the nurse came in, "Nandarani, Nandarani, you have a child," and she woke up and found the baby boy. I didn't realize that she also gave birth to a girl. Today is Subhadra's birthday. I mean, if last night was Janmashtami, the following day is the birthday of Subhadra and Srila Prabhupada, which, because it was the next day that the good news was broadcast throughout the land, that Nanda had a baby son, and Srila Prabhupada appeared on that day to broadcast that message worldwide. So, yeah, so anyway, Krishna's various pastimes in Braj, his killing of the demons demonstrates how he kills the anarthas in her heart, beginning with Putana, who is pseudo-guru. meaning one who teaches material advancement, karma, and gyan in the name of spiritual life. That's an anartha. And Krishna has to kill that obstacle to his infant pastimes in our hearts. And then, you know, actually, all these demons have their, you know, more obvious and their subtler significance. Putana also means a guru who is qualified, but who doesn't consider the qualification of the disciple and gives initiation without considering whether the disciple is qualified. And that is damaging to the disciple's heart, the disciple's spiritual life. Specifically means one who approaches a guru for Siddha Pranali, and the guru gives the Siddha Pranali without considering if anyone in this world is competent to receive that type of initiation in this age. Because if you find out that you're a 13-year-old unmarried gopi, you have to maintain that identity and function for the rest of your life, and that might be very awkward in this world. And it might just destroy your spiritual life. So that's Putana in her subtler form. And Krishna has to destroy all these things. If you want to know your Siddha Pranali mantra, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati has given it. It is Trinadapi Sunichena, Tadarapi Sahishnana, Amanida Manadena, Kirtaniya Siddhari. So, as Krishna grows, he's manifesting his pastimes of killing the demons that follow Putana with the growing Krishna consciousness within our hearts. And Balaram kills some of them. And Shiva Bhaktivinoda Thakur says that the demons killed by Balaram represent the anarthas where there's more emphasis on our own endeavor to overcome them. Now, any devotee is going to say, well, what endeavor of my own can overcome these anarthas? Shiva Bhaktivinoda Thakur further explains that when our desire is very strong and determined and devotional and humble, then Krishna will appear in our hearts, and Balaram will appear in our hearts to kill such demons as Dinakashura and Palamba. And understand, these anarthas, they present themselves oftentimes as your dear most friend and well-wisher, as did Palamba. He knew what cowherd boy could not come out and play that day. Nobody else knew. Palamba knew. And he assumed a form exactly resembling in every aspect of physical appearance and behavior and emotional constitution that very cowherd boy. And nobody knew this is a demon, except Krishna and Balaram. So they're playing their games. You know, thieves and cops and robbers, and you know, all the different games. And whoever lost had to carry his victor on his shoulders. So Krishna lost. And he had to carry Sridhama on his shoulders. This is a wonder that, you know, Kunti Devi, Bhishma, Kolavet Sridhar are pondering in great relish. creation within his heart had to carry Sri Rama on his shoulders. And Balaram, who won, he had two main teams, Krishna and Balaram. Balaram won, so he got to go for a ride on the shoulders of Pralamba. And then Pralamba just took off into the forest. And Balaram was thinking, that's not part of the game. He's taking me away from my friends. That's not how the game works. And then he rose into the sky and assumed his horrible, hideous Rakshasa form. And Balaram got scared. This is a demon. Maybe there's another one back there trying to kill Krishna. So I better not stay scared. I better do something. So with his fist, he smashed him in the head, brought him down, ran back to make sure Krishna was all right. So Pralamba is the thief in disguise who really strives to steal yourself away from yourself, which means Mayavad. Which doesn't just mean that I'm God, you're God, we're all God, we just forgot it, we have to remember, we become God again. That's pretty hard to fall for, but there are very, very, very subtle, deceptive refinements of the Mayavad that infiltrate even into Vaishnav camps. But this subtle form of Mayavad, this Pralamba, presents itself as your best friend by speaking the same words as does your guru. And you look and say, oh, this is the same words as my guru speaks. And then you put your faith in that person. You don't know their heart. So when you surrender to one who has Pralamba in his heart, the infant Krishna in your consciousness is jeopardized. And you can't tell. The subtle refinements of Mayavad, because it cloaks itself behind the Vaishnav words and the Vaishnav gestures and the Vaishnav etiquette and the Vaishnav worship. Everything is Vaishnav, except for one very subtle element deep within the heart. Therefore, we must take shelter of a deep humility which attracts Balaram to come and protect us from being or having our Krishna consciousness killed by that Mayavad. And after all the obstacles to Braj are eliminated, then Akura comes to take Krishna and Balaram to Mathura. And when they stop to bathe in Jamuna, and Akura sees in the Jamuna Krishna and Balaram, and he goes, no, down the chariot. He looks back in the Jamuna, he sees Shesh, with Vishnu lying on his coils like a couch. And he goes back to the chariot, looking very bewildered. And Krishna says, did you see something wonderful? After seeing you, what is wonderful? And he takes them to Mathura. And after killing Chandra and Mushtika, and then, jumping up onto the dais, grabbing Kamsa by the hair, you rascal, you killed all my brothers, you have imprisoned my mother and father, and I've had it with you. He killed him. And everybody knew that nobody in this world could kill Kamsa. So after killing him, and dragging him around to make it sure, real clear, he's dead and gone, Krishna and Balaram ran up to Vasudeva Devaki. They wanted to get hugged, but they didn't get any hugs because Vasudeva Devaki, seeing Krishna kill Kamsa, understood he is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And because of that reverence, due to their Aishwarya nature, they could not embrace him. And Krishna Balaram just stood there. You mean after 11 years? You know, you never even met Balaram. And you just met me one brief night. And you're just standing there like this? And they just stood there like this. Because their parental affection was so distanced by this display of the mighty opulence and power of the Supreme Transcendental Order God. It just froze them in reverence. And Krishna and Balaram were really hurt that after all these years, you're not even going to give us a hug. And they started to cry. And those tears trickling down the cheeks of their sons flooded that Aishwarya in a flow of Madhurya. And then when Balaram fell at the feet of Vasudev, he picked him up and embraced him, which was just what he wanted, and smelled his head in great familial love. And Vasudev picked up Krishna, covered his head with his sari, and began to feed him after 11 years. And in that exchange, everyone's heartfelt desires was almost completely fulfilled, but Devaki still had some feeling of uneasiness in her heart. She was not still completely satisfied, even with realizing, you know, reunion with her son. What's the matter? And she said, Krishna, when you went to Gurukul, you brought back the dead son of your teacher. Could you bring back my six sons? And Krishna went to Balaram, let's go. And they went, got the sons, brought them back, still little babies, handed the Devaki, and in motherly affection, she breastfed them all, and immediately upon tasting that breast milk of Mother Devaki, because of the one time it had been taken by Krishna before his sojourn to Gokul, it was Mahaprasad. And immediately tasting that Mahaprasad, they were liberated. They went back to their original position. And Devaki was just lost in wonder. So, Shukadeva Goswami begins the 10th canto by telling Maharaj Pariksit that the pastimes and instructions of Krishna are like a boat. And what is the symbology of a boat? That's your means for crossing over. And the ocean symbolizes a very vast expanse that you can't cross on your own, and it is filled with all kinds of wonders and all kinds of dangers. So the standard Vedic analogy is, you know, the human body is like a boat. Spiritual masters, the helmsmen, the Vedic hymns, and the favorable breezes, which are. But in 10th canto, Shukadeva Goswami is giving a different version. That the boat is Krishna's instructions and pastimes. He said, by that boat, your grandfathers were able to cross over that vast ocean called Kurukshetra, filled with, you know, such entities as Timangila, who could have easily swallowed them. They were so heavily overpowered by the Kaurava's might, including Bhishma, Dronacharya. It was Krishna's instructions. Following, surrendering to Krishna's instructions that awarded the empowerment to cross over that very dangerous field like the ocean. So, Krishna imparted instructions instructions to all of us in the midst of that ocean, Kurukshetra, in the Bhagavad Gita. And Arjuna remembered those instructions. But he didn't take them to heart so deeply and so feelingly and so fervently until Krishna's pastimes progressed toward their termination. And when the disaster, apparent disaster, occurred at Prabhash, and Krishna sent Daruka. And after Daruka saw all Krishna's weapons appear before him, and then with his horses and chariots all ascend to the sky, what does this mean for Daruka, Krishna's chariot driver? When the chariot and horses ascended to Vaikuntha, Daruka saw that, what's my service to me? And Krishna told him to go back to Dwarka. And he returned, just blinded by tears. And in Dwarka, he had a very important function, because Arjuna, hearing that the Jadu dynasty and Balaram and Krishna have left this world, his continual impulse was to commit suicide. And Daruka had to keep reminding him, no, you have an instruction from Krishna, a mission, to take the queens to Indraprastha. Daruka had to keep reminding him, and Arjuna fixed his mind. And they brought the queens over to the mainland. And just then, ominous dark clouds crisscrossed with lightning, making thunder which just shook the earth, as if the earth was trying to cast off one last burden. It wasn't the burden of the demons who she had called Krishna to come and kill. It was another burden. It was a loving burden. It was the burden of the Jadus. So when the earth began to tremor and the lightning was striking Dwarka and the waves were surging in the rain was pouring, and as the queens and the whatever Jadus were left turned to look back one last time at their residence, he saw Dwarka slip down beneath the sea, and under the roaring, boiling waters which covered over Dwarka, which they could barely see between their own tears and the rainfall, they had to bid farewell to their abode as Arjuna led the caravan on its last trek from Dwarka to Indraprastha. And on the way, what Srila Prabhupada explains as a group of infidel cowherd men arrested Arjuna, took the queens into their custody, and as they herded those queens off, as they were screaming and calling out to Arjuna for protection, he took his Gandiva bow, but he did not even have the strength to string it. He called for his weapons, but they didn't answer and come. He tried to call out his divine incantations. He couldn't remember the mantras. And as the queens were screaming and the cowherd men were mocking him, he was defeated by a group of cowherd men. And when he reached Indraprastha, the news had already been broadcast over the universe. Arjuna has been defeated by a band of cowherd men. And feeling himself completely stripped of every last thread of self-dignity, he understood. Krishna bestowed that empowerment for a particular function and purpose. Now he's withdrawn it because he has another purpose for me. And he told his brothers, let's go. And without second thought, they went. And Subhadra and Draupadi, in their own way, followed and speared their husbands. As the Pandavas ascended higher and higher into the Himalayas, following the footsteps of their forefathers. And as the air became so thin and the vegetation so sparse, there's no question of maintaining material life here. And there's no question of returning back. Arjuna, who had been contemplating more and more during this series of the final pastimes, Krishna's instruction, I am not manifest to the foolish and intelligent. To them, I'm covered by that curtain of Yoga Maya. And then Arjuna's resolve was, I must get through that curtain. And then, as they ascended higher and higher to the Himalayas, his focus shifted from that verse to another verse, which resounded in his heart. And he was convinced, because my friend promised me, I promise you this, you'll come to me because you're my very dear friend. So then the high elevations of the Himalayan peaks became an adventure. Arjuna was eager to enter. And in his great anticipation, remembering Krishna's words, always remember me, become my devotee, worship me, offer your homage unto me, and doing so, you will come to me, I promise, Sakha, my very dear friend. Arjuna became jubilant, understanding that his death was approaching and seeing it as a door opening to eternal life. And in his ecstasy, he sharp, stony trail beneath his feet transformed into a marble pathway. Those jagged Himalayan peaks turned into golden domes. And for an instant, before his eyes were blinded by tears, he saw within one of those palaces of Aprakat Dwarka, his friend, Moksha. Remember, I promised you, Sakha, you'll come to me. And then he lost that vision as his eyes flooded with tears. But even without material vision, he was irresistibly drawn into the gates of Aprakat Dwarka to be with his friend once again. And in so doing, he left us a precious lesson. Krishna has left his pastimes and his instructions. And the essence of Bhagavad Gita is to always remember Krishna. But how can we remember Krishna? The mind is always going to its love. And our minds are attached to so many things that we're distracted in our attempts to remember Krishna. Therefore, Krishna has come again in the role of his own devotee to teach us how to love him and to understand how to love himself. The object of love became the subject of love. The beloved became the lover. Because it's just like, if you're a mother, then your child is the object of your love. You're the subject of maternal love. No, take it the other way around. If you're a child, then you're the object of maternal love. You don't really understand the full paradigm of maternal love until you become a mother. You're the subject, someone else is the object. So you don't really understand love until you see it from both sides, subject and object. So Krishna was contemplating, I don't understand this love because I'm the object. I can't get a full perspective without becoming the subject. So he became a devotee to learn how to love Krishna and to teach us how to do the same. And it's all based on chanting the holy name. And when we chant the holy name with attention and devotion, gradually, as that holy name takes root within our hearts, Krishna will take birth on the throne which Balaram prepares for him within the depths of our pure consciousness. And then his pastimes of birth and childhood and growth and maturity will unmanifest in our meditation. And in so doing, as his pastimes blossom like a lotus within our hearts, we will find our own form and function in the entourage of the Lord. And then, as we approach the final hour, we can remember Arjuna being very eager, or as his grandson, Maharaj Pariksit, experienced. That's a doorway opening to your eternal life. Maharaj Pariksit, after 7 days, no eating, no sleeping, no even drinking water, told Sukadev, "I'm not hungry, I'm not thirsty, I don't want to sleep. My only concern is you continue narrating these pastimes, which is sustaining my soul." So Krishna takes birth in this world to violate his own, not violate, supersede his own law, that he's never manifest to the foolish and unintelligent. To them he's ever covered with his curtain of yoga maya. But then how would they ever be delivered? So once in a day of Brahma, 8.64 billion years. He doesn't break his own law. He supersedes it with a higher law, which is the law of love. And he does appear, even before the miscreants and foolish and unintelligent, and reveals himself in his pastimes. And what does this mean? How and why does the unborn take birth in this world? It's a gesture of his desire to take birth in our hearts. It's his endeavor to awaken our dormant, loving service mood, so that we can actually see him and serve him and remember him always and enter into his eternal lila of loving exchange. Thank you very much. Are there any questions or comments?
When we are trying to cultivate humility, we might act humbly, but we are not. I'm not very humble, but we try to act humbly because that's what we are taught. My question is that just by doing these acts, usually you become humble, or
it depends. It depends on whether you're acting humbly to impress someone, or whether you're acting humbly to please Guru and Krishna. If you're acting that way to please, you'll be empowered with the actual character to complement your actions. If you're doing it to deceive, I mean, even in a good way, just to please your parents, that you're acting in a cultured way, but it's not really for the sake of pleasing Krishna, it'll have some cultural merits, but it won't do much for you spiritually. The same thing, if you understand the purpose of it. The purpose of acting humbly, even when you don't feel humble, is to show Krishna that you're trying. And if your motive, your purpose, your incentive is to please Krishna by trying to be humble, even when your consciousness is not feeling that, then Krishna will award the realization, the blessing, the merit to integrate what you're trying to show with what you really want. If it's based on his pleasure, then his blessings will integrate our actions and our consciousness. So it's showing. We're supposed to act humble to show Krishna, this is the way I want to be. And if you do want to be that way, gradually the feeling will come by the grace of Krishna. But if you're doing that because you want to impress people that I'm humble, then you're just cultivating your own pride. You're just feeding your own ego.
Interpretation of the same question. My personal experience is that usually it's a combination.
That's all right. Just keep cultivating the desirable aspect of it. I'm not saying we could just instantaneously become pure in our desire. It's going to be mixed, but cultivate the positive side and starve the negative. Excuse me for a moment. that answer your question? See, all our spiritual advancement is based on the pleasure of Krishna. So if we act humbly with mixed motives, well, but understanding that the motive we want to cultivate is Krishna's pleasure, that'll evoke empowerment to actually develop the proper feelings that accompany the gestures. I mean, it's good that, you know, Indian families especially, they teach their children to be humble, to act humbly. It's a, you know, precious cultural trait. But, and it'll, you know, have all kinds of benefits. But the pure spiritual benefit comes in understanding that its prime motive should be to please Krishna, which will also include pleasing parents and family and society and everything. But if we're clear on that ultimate purpose, then Krishna will award the empowerment to integrate the feelings and the consciousness with the gestures, and everything will become holistic.
I have a question. I didn't understand the last part of what you had mentioned. But it's always that as we try to come out of the Tamil Guru and get into the Indian Krishna consciousness, we have a feeling of satisfaction and different feeling that it's really dangerous because material world looks very really good in that time. And we wanted to help us safeguard our property. Krishna then gives rest to come to us. I didn't understand why Krishna is coming into the trail.
Nothing is bad in the arrangement of the Lord. Yes, Kamsa is a demon, but he represents something that's very, very essential, very helpful, very protective, and that's fear. Srila Prabhupada told his young American followers that, you know, he really appreciated their qualities. You know, they're enthusiastic, they have good karma, they get things done, they have a certain kind of integrity. He said, you have one big problem. You're not adequately afraid of Maya. And in retrospect, that is shown to be quite true. We have to learn to have a healthy fear of Maya. And Maya is also good, but she's good if we have a relationship with a healthy fear integrated. Because, you know, her ultimate purpose is to return us to Krishna. But in the process, she's going to tempt us and see if we really want Krishna or if we want independence from Krishna. So, as our senses become more purified, we perceive, you know, the subtle embellishments of wonder and charm in the material world. That's all right. You can see that. But you must understand that is for Krishna's enjoyment. Krishna's pleasure is part of Krishna's arrangement for Krishna's purpose. And we have to see it and interact and utilize it in that consciousness. Otherwise, the purified consciousness is going to also have an influence of taking us into the material world deeper. If we don't have that healthy fear. But it's not that you just get paranoid. It's you turn it to Krishna. You turn to Krishna for protection. And by offering everything to Krishna, Krishna, this is, yes, this material world is wonderful. It is beautiful. It is perfect in its own right. But it's not meant to enjoy. It's meant for Krishna's enjoyment. And what is Krishna's enjoyment? That we learn how to utilize everything in this world for his pleasure. You see a beautiful flower blooming. You got a choice. I can enjoy, or I can understand what this flower is telling me. Take me to Krishna for his enjoyment. And if you do that, you'll find deep satisfaction and enjoyment within your own heart. If you try to enjoy it independently, you'll find dissatisfaction and discord in being separated from Krishna because of your independent will. Independent will is a good thing if we surrender to Krishna. So, you know, the highest gift is love. The highest attainment is love. But love is not possible with the choice of rejecting love. Because if we're just programmed to love, then we're no better than a robot or a computer. And we can't really love. Love necessitates that free will. Because love will not impose itself. And love cannot be forced. It necessitates a free, willing giving of oneself to constitute true love. And that necessitates the independence of refusing it, of rejecting it. That's what the material world is for, that option. But all the time the material world is teaching us that that option just brings you frustration, misery, emptiness, loneliness, and fear. That message in the whole material creation is wonderful and beautiful because it's a perfect arrangement to redirect our consciousness back to the shelter of Krishna. It comes, that fear element is helpful in reminding us of the proper relationship of things. So yes, Kamsa is a demon. But he's good in how he serves the Lord's mission. Not that Kamsa is good, but his function is good because Krishna utilizes it in his own lila and in teaching us how to fear material nature. Which just means you don't try to enjoy it. It means you turn to Krishna for protection. Through Shravanam, Kirtanam, Smaranam, which keeps you fixed on the purpose of material nature, to teach us. And part of the teaching process is you utilize her gifts in the service of Krishna, for the pleasure of Krishna, and then fear his fulfilled his purpose. And at a certain point, Krishna will kill the fear too. But until we're on that level, we must maintain a healthy. But, you know, fear, like demons, they have their role, they have their function. But we have to keep them, we have to draw boundaries. Okay, fear, you have this part of my consciousness. Don't trespass and take over my mind. Because outside, when fear trespasses, it becomes toxic, and then you become neurotic. That's not good. Devotees should be peaceful, even though they have that element of fear to protect them from falling into the traps of Maya. But the fear should be utilized as your servant, not your master. That's just a matter of, you know, teaching it its boundaries. And utilizing it for its proper function. Yes.
how do we recognize these tamasas, whether they are rising or they are going down, or how we actually see?
Well, that's why the demons are so perfect in their ability to transmute. Putana is hideous, ghastly, rakshasi, who lived off the blood of infant children. But she appeared as such a beautiful lady that they just gave her free access to the house and free access to Krishna. So anarthas are very perfectly deceptive. So you have to look indirectly. You evaluate their influence and whether they're rising or falling in control over you by your attraction to Krishna consciousness, to devotional service, to the nectar of the holy name, and the nectar of serving Vaishnavas. When those elements are strong, it means the demoniac elements are weak. But if the attraction to the holy name, to the service of Vaishnavas, is weak, that means the anarthas are becoming strong, and they're stealing away the energy which is meant to be directed towards our Krishna consciousness. I mean, sometimes you can see that, like, you know, you just get angry and curse somebody. Well, you know, a demon overpowered you at that time. But, you know, when it's suppressed and it goes into hiding and it transmutes, you may think, I'm free of anger. Beware. Sometimes the demons, you know, make their influence unknown so they can gather strength to strike harder later. So you can't really tell by, you know, directly observing them whether they're getting stronger or weaker. You can look at your Krishna consciousness and see if it's becoming stronger or weaker. That'll tell you the state indirectly, inversely, the effect of the demons or anarchists in our hearts. Talking about just all activities of Krishna consciousness, just going through the gestures, even you don't feel it. It's the same thing. Act humble, act devotional, act everything. We're just putting on a big act. So we're really like little putanas. We're guising ourselves as nice devotees. You know, we dress in dhotis and saris and put on tilak, but we know what's in our hearts. So in a sense, we're all like little putanas. But go to Krishna. He'll draw out the best and he'll eliminate the rest. So it's hypocrisy if you're doing it with an incentive to deceive. And that we don't want. But if you feel some, you know, disparity that, you know, I'm acting like a good devotee, but I don't really feel like a good devotee. Well, if you're acting a certain way, because you want to become that way, genuinely, and you're imploring Krishna's mercy to help you, it'll come. It'll give you the actual character and qualities to match the way you're acting and the way you want to be. If you're doing it to deceive or to impress others, it'll take you away from Krishna. If your motive, and even if you don't really have that pure motive, if you're cultivating that motive, will come. It's a matter of what we're feeling. I mean, we have, you know, demoniac qualities mixed with divine qualities in our conditioned state. The one that's going to grow and become strong and overpower the other is the one you feed. You feed the divine qualities by sadhana. You feed the demoniac qualities by surrendering to their will. Whenever you give in to an anartha, say, what's anartha we can mention in class? Well, just, you know, looking at some sense object. Well, you know, there will be a certain karmic reaction to that. But there will also be a subtle conditioning to that. That every time you give in to that impulse, you're feeding your conditioning to do the same. Whereas conversely, every time you resist that impulse, you're feeding your conditioning to restrain. So every time you give in to an anartha, there's two levels of reaction. One is just the gross karmic reaction. The two is, you know, conditioning. You know, it may sound like such a mystical thing. It just means habit, really. And then when the more times you do something, the stronger that impulse becomes. And then the more times you have to do the opposite to, you know, counteract it. So it's important that we, you know, watch our behavior and how we're influenced by the modes, because the more you give in to them, the more power you're giving them over you. The more you resist them by Krishna's grace, the more power you're developing in restraint. And then you get pride, proud, which is the worst in artha. And therefore you have to give credit, all glory to Sri Guru and Garaga and all things, to protect you from that worst demon, who is actually the original demon, pride. So you have to watch it when you're doing very well at resisting temptations. You don't fall for the worst one, which is, oh, I'm doing very good. You may be doing very well, but it's only by the grace of Guru and Krishna. Never forget that. And that remembrance will protect you. I'll give you an example. There are sadhus in the world who are just incredibly renounced, detached, strict in their vows of, you know, worshiping, let's say, Ram. They worship Krishna also, but let's say Ram, because, and, you know, a neophyte devotee may look at these sadhus and observe their behavior, and they hardly eat, they hardly sleep, they're always going before the deity, and even when no one is watching, they're offering their pranams and their prayers with great feeling and emotion, visible signs of emotion, even when there's no one watching. And if you, you know, observe this, you're going to be inspired. I want to take the association of that person. I want to take instruction from that person. If that person is not authorized, is not recommended by your Guru Maharaj, you don't know. By taking that person's association, by developing intimate relationship with that person, if that person is harboring Pralambha, deep in the concealed chambers of his heart, and you become intimate and confidential with that sadhu. I mean intimate in terms of revealing the mind and heart and receiving worthy instructions accordingly. Then you'll find that at a certain point, after you've heard everything in Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam and maybe Ramayana, and it's word for word the way your guru has said it, and you got faith, this person is speaking exactly what my guru does. I have faith and I surrender. When you really surrender your heart, you are eligible for the most confidential knowledge. Just as Bhagavad Gita has its section of the most confidential knowledge, so does Prahlamba. And Prahlamba's confidential knowledge, which he does not reveal to you until you're surrendered, mind, body, words, heart, and soul. The most confidential knowledge is that beyond Krishna, beyond the holy name, beyond the deity, is the absolute, unmanifest, unborn, all-pervading. And by all this puja and chanting, we will merge into that non-characterized nothingness of bliss. But it's not expressed until you've surrendered. And then you realize, I surrendered to Prahlamba, the thief in disguise whose motive is to steal yourself away from itself. And it's appropriate that Balaram killed that demon to show that we need the shelter of the spiritual master who can detect these subtleties that we can't. I mean, there are sadhus who, you know, to our observation, display all the characteristics of pure loving devotional service. But we can't see what's in their heart, deep. I mean, some Mayavadis are gross and it's obvious. But all these anarthas have their gross, obvious, and their very subtle, imperceptible manifestations. And we can't perceive. Only God can, and he reveals that to the spiritual master for our protection. Therefore, it is essential to have that Guru Bhadashraya from one who's in the authorized disciplic succession. And his, you know, verified, my Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra as being authentic. Otherwise, we don't know. We may be developing friendship with a very sweet, charming, friendly cowherd boy who's chanting Jai Krishna, Jai Balaram. But his real name is Prahlamba. Material nature has such, you know, deceptive devices to teach us that we really have to sincerely, wholeheartedly take shelter in the authorized sampradayas. Yes, first of all, very good question. Very good concept of, you know, some protection because you're in the sampradaya. Yes. The subtleties of this demoniac nature do infiltrate even the Vaishnava sampradayas. Yes, it's an unfortunate reality, they do. Yes, you receive some protection just by the merit of taking shelter within that sampradaya. An example that we might relate to is Putana, pseudo guru. Because, you know, Srila Prabhupada, you know, it's kind of like Lord Ram recruiting monkeys and bears into his army to go rescue Sita. But Srila Prabhupada did it on a more, on a deeper level. He recruited those who were less than monkeys and didn't just send them into war with Maya, but sent them out preaching. And, you know, many of those candidates had some sincere desire to serve Srila Prabhupada, but they also had material desires. I mean, they all did. So Srila Prabhupada offered, you know, the opportunity to serve as guru, whether initiating guru or just whatever, he offered that opportunity. And he certified some to act in that role, and some of them failed. But the wonderful blessing of Guru Tattva is that if you serve a guru who's trying to sincerely act in that role, but is not pure, and at some point is actually carried away by material desires, your spiritual life is not finished. The wonderful nature of Guru Tattva is if you are serving one guru who becomes disqualified due to succumbing to material desire, Guru Tattva will just take your devotional life and your devotional sentiments and your devotional merits and place them in the shelter of one who is qualified. It doesn't go in vain. Unless, once again, your own motive was to cheat. Which we all have within us, but if it wasn't the primary motive, your sentiment was genuine and sincere, the person failed, Krishna will redirect you. And nothing has been lost. Because Guru Tattva is a principle, it's not one person. I mean, the person is the agent who is crucial. But if one agent fails, Krishna will replace him with another agent. And to the, you know, depth of your sincerity, he will guide you accordingly. Because, you know, you also have to watch for the other extreme. Oh, I surrendered to this person and they failed me, therefore I have an excuse to give up my devotional service. No, you don't.
But sometimes it may happen
still because it does happen. Yeah. Yeah, we see these things. I mean, what Srila Prabhupada did, transporting Krishna consciousness on the Western soil, recruiting, you know, hippie ranks, is like phenomenal. And obviously there's going to be problems with that. But the problems are temporary. The benefits are eternal. Therefore he took the chance. With that faith.
Well, when Balaram killed the demon, are they all going to be in? And what I've noticed is when you were talking about humility and kind of self-reception, things that you to work on and to have the right kind of motive in, that praying for awareness can be helpful. Like to be able to be reflected from the emotions because they're so ugly, we don't really know how to kind of face them. We're not even fully aware of that in our consciousness. But praying for their kind of appearance.
Yeah, well, the mirror that reflects them before our eyes to see is our relationships. Because, you know, you'll see people, and, you know, maybe it's because they couldn't handle living with devotees. So they went off into seclusion and chanted 64 rounds for 10 years and became self-realized and had sufficient merit to come back into the society in perfect standing, and within 1 or 2 days find out that they still can't get along with devotees at all, which means they deceived themselves for 10, 20 years. The mirror that, you know, shows to yourself, and if you don't want to acknowledge them, don't hold that mirror up to the world, is your relationships. How are your relationships? You know, this is all fighting and quarreling and competing. And the demons are very active. But if you take that and take shelter of Krishna, Krishna, please subdue them. And sincerely petition him to do so, he will, and then you'll see that, you know, you start seeing devotees in a different light of appreciation. And even though they are just impossible to get along with, sometimes they're essential to our spiritual advancement. You have to balance the two by Krishna's grace. But also understand that we were talking the other night. Draupadi never really got over the insult, the atrocity committed to her. So she had no problem inciting Arjuna and Bhima to retaliate, but nobody could do anything independent of Maharaj Yudhisthira's sanction. So at different times she was, you know, trying to incite him to do something to retaliate, and he never would. But he answered in different ways. One time he said, he told her, this is such an appropriate instruction for us all, that Krishna places us into varieties of association to work out our karma. I mean, Srila Prabhupada has said similar things. Don't be, you know, upset with the agent of your karma. But also see it in context of the time factor. When you surrender to Krishna, and you're trying to conclude your earthly existence, that means all the karmic debts since time immemorial have to, you know, come up and be resolved. So a lot of stuff is going to come up. When you surrender to Krishna, you're living mainly in the association of devotees. So who is eligible to be the main agents of your karma? It's the devotees. So if you see that that's what's going on, then it doesn't become a personal thing. I can't stand that person. He's the agent of my karma. He brought me a debt, you know, to be reconsidered. So what am I going to do with it? If I get angry and retaliate, you just, you know, increase the debt, the karmic debt. But to take the comes to Samiksha Mano, if you just humbly, gratefully, thank you. You've brought me this reaction to give me the opportunity to accept it with humility. And if I do, it's just nullified. I'm that much closer to Krishna, closer to home. Thank you for your insult. actually transpiring is helpful to see things in the proper light. But we shouldn't take advantage of that. Oh, I want to be the agent of your karma. I want to get back at you for things you did to me. And then it's gone to the other extreme and just becomes toxic again. So we should be very, very, very careful that we're not serving exclusively as the agent of others' karma. If Krishna uses us for that, well, let it be, but you know, don't overdo that. Your enthusiasm for that particular service, or you will be implicated. And therefore you see amongst, you know, mature, cultured, refined, advanced devotees that even when they have to present you with some of your karma, they do it in such a sweet way that you just happily accept. Those who are not so advanced, refined, and mature, you may come on a little course, and then you're more inclined to be reactive. But if you're reactive, then you're not settling the debt. You might even be increasing it. And do not encourage or sanction that behavior either. But you know, retaliation isn't going to improve the behavior. A devotional response will soften the behavior. Forgiveness. Forgiveness does not negate the hurt or put some, you know, happy heading on it. But forgiveness acknowledges to Krishna that I'm not going to let this hurt impede relationships, because those relationships are my connection with you, Krishna. Acceptance, mitigates most of the hurt. Forgiveness perfects it. It doesn't mean the hurt's going to go away. But forgiveness and acceptance means we're not going to let this come between us and a relationship that's in connection with Krishna. You may adjust the relationship as to not encourage or facilitate abuse. But yeah, forgiveness.
Once before, in my day, I was used to doing, but
Well, that's a very important point, because you know, unfortunately, in our society, there has been abuse, and some of it has been atrocious. And I've heard from the so-called victims of such abuse in a very humble and sincere and genuine plea that I don't have it within me to forgive the person. I know I must. I don't have it within me. What do I do? There's another way to go about it. And that is to approach or pray to someone with such an abundance of forgiveness to do it on your behalf. And then you get the credit for that. It's a genuine experience. There are people who know they need to forgive, but they don't have it within themselves to do so. You don't have to have it within yourself. But you do have to have within yourself the merit to defy your own ego and say, I'm going to pray to someone who has sufficient merit to forgive on my behalf. And then you get the benefit from that. You get the benefit of having forgiven. But you went about it another way, which is within your power and ability. I didn't say any specific person, because there's no one specific person who has that merit to forgiving ability. It has to be someone who's Krishna conscious. It can be Krishna, depending, but usually, I don't know Krishna. I only know devotees. Not exactly. I mean, the Christians would pray to Jesus to do it because he is, to them, the emblem of forgiveness. It's a matter of your own relationships. And, a little compassion is helpful because, when people act out in abrasive ways, it's because they're hurt. They've been hurt. They are hurt. And that's the only way to know how to interact. And it's really a call for empathy and love. And to just react, fight back, it just aggravates the whole paradigm. Whereas, a genuine act of empathy and forgiveness, if it has sufficient potency to it, you can just cancel out the whole syndrome. It can't be done artificially, but we can invoke higher powers to assist us.
Regarding this forgiving thing, sometimes, we try to forgive on gross level, that thing is there, it might pop up after a month or 2 months or even 6 months, something for which you were hurt sometime back, and you are trying on gross level to, forgive someone, and you are trying to serve them so that you get out of that cycle. But, it pops up, you don't know when it will again pop up, and I think it's funny.
Yeah, it hasn't been realized on the subtle level until you can honestly say you're the well-wisher of that person. So in the meantime, in the interim between the gross and the subtle realization, you might need to make some practical adjustments like, avoiding situations where it might erupt. But the thing we have to continuously work on is just, purifying and softening our own hearts through our sadhana and prayer. That, Krishna, I don't want to be like this. I am like this. I'm exposing it to you, which you already know anyway. But please, free me of these demons.
Thank you.
Yeah, but philosophically, what's transpiring there? You know, your false ego is saying, oh, get back. And then your intelligence says, I'm sick of listening to you. You are making me sick. And I'm going to invoke a higher power to override you. And you evoke the higher power of well-wisher. And then false ego is defeated by that. It may not be dead and gone. It may rise again later, but you have defeated it in that particular battle by such a change of consciousness and shift of heart. Yeah, that's really, you know, going the extra mile. Oh, I can't stand this person, but I'm going to try not to get reactive and try to control myself. Well, you know, there you go. You're on a fine line, but if you just go to the other extreme, I will envision, you know, something for that person, which is, you know, my highest aspiration, and confer that upon that person. You know, the false ego is just killed by that. It can't survive in that kind of thought. It doesn't mean it's dead and gone, but it just, it's defeated. And then, you know, you have inaugurated a pattern of conditioning, which is highly devotional. And if you just keep feeding that, starving the other, then that'll become your orientation in time. You know, when, you had a wonderful example, when, you know, in the Mahabharata, description of, you know, the Pandavas retired timely, and, you know, they're dropping one by one, and Yudhishthira is the last to drop, and then when he dies, he sees in heaven his Dhritarashtra, no, Duryodhana and Dushasana living in these magnificently opulent palaces and just enjoying heavenly delights. But his brothers are calling to him from hell. What kind of arrangement is this? My brothers are put in hell. Duryodhana and Dushasana are enjoying like anything in heaven. So you have that, you know, practical manifestation of that even in the Pandavas experience. So, you know, we can, but of course it was just like an illusion that the Pandavas were in hell. It's just something Maharishi just had to experience because of that, you know, his hesitation to carry out the will of Krishna. It's not, he didn't do it, he just hesitated. But he had to see that glimpse of hell. But then it was revealed, oh, you're here, brothers are in heaven. I don't know if we want to be there either. How long are we going to be in heaven? Not long, because you're with Krishna. And wherever he goes, you'll be there. But that's like a Shastric, you know, demonstration of the principle you just described. You know, we can use these things in our creative visualization to help us overcome enmity.
I'm just thinking, if you were saying that, if I had, like, I was thinking that person in that situation, if I hadn't, you know, done that here and had experienced it later, then of course would be envy, you know, but because that was a great practice. Oh, of course. I was just going to say, was there's the stand that I have, you know, so I love this person and then maybe because it is so long. And I said, well, there must be something good about it. And I said, look, it's gone around this house. It's fine. It's just sometimes I don't have all that fun.
Or one thing that you admire.
Yeah.
Or appreciate.
And I said, oh, okay. So the whole lot of opportunity that I bought, right? So there's one thing that I said, but, you know, some of them.
Yeah, what we were discussing last night, Shiva Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati's strategy when two disciples weren't getting along, he'd bring them together and ask one, you know, glorify that one. And he couldn't think of anything, but then he'd come up with something like, I really appreciate that you eat prasadam. And then he'd say that one, you know, glorify that one. Oh God, what can I think of? Oh, you sleep in the temple. But as soon as you start and come up with something, it may be pretty basic, but with every item you come up with, the heart gets softened a little bit. And then you start thinking of other things. Like, oh, this person may be a murderer and rapist, but he helped a little old lady across the street. So, you know, the more you practice and the more you come up with, then the better ones you're going to come up with and the more of them, then the heart's just going to soften more and more until the other thing shrinks into perspective. And the virtues become more prominent. But then what's the next step? You know, creation begins from subtle to gross. If you're envisioning a person, oh, you're a demon, you're giving fuel to them acting in that way. But if you're envisioning, oh, you're such a nice person, and maybe even express it, then you're activating that. I mean, I've, not only with horses, you know, because, you know, I'm known as a person who has ability with horses that others don't have, and they say, well, you know, what's your trick? And it's not a trick. It's largely just your attitude. But it works in diesel engines also. I say diesel because, you know, they don't even have an ignition system. So it's not like some, you know, mystic, you know, electronic thing that I can't even understand. You're just talking about, you know, heat and combustion and things like that. You know, somebody be trying to start a diesel engine. I'll start it. I'll just go over and, you know, push the button thing and start it up. Well, what's your trick? And there's no trick. It's your attitude. You're seeing this old 1951 bulldozer as a piece of junk. I'm seeing it as a gift. Those molecules are responding to our consciousness. And, you know, because you're seeing this thing as a piece of junk, and your message is so negative, you know, the molecules and the energy fields and everything is just getting depressed, and it's not bringing forth life. I'm seeing this as a gift. This can do so much service for Krishna. And then it comes right to life for me. It's not like a trick I had, you know, somewhat, it's an attitude. So if it works with a 1951 bulldozer, how much more is it going to work with devotees? I mean, a 1951 bulldozer is, you know, pretty, you know, it's not like the most refined, you know, devotional sentiment. It's a useful tool. It's how we built the Vrindavan, but it's not like something that's like, you know, highly sensitized to rasa. But it'll pick up on your attitudes enough to dramatically show how one person can't get it started and the other has no problem starting it. Because, you know, quantum physics means you can't have a, you know, you can't analyze a creation without consciousness factoring into everything in it. So anyway, back to the example of, you know, appreciating others. You know, the more you feel and express that appreciation, the more you're activating that aspect of a person's demeanor. You know, you got one ornery person in New Vrindavan, and you know, half the community just doesn't want to deal with the guy. And he is just ornery to the max with them, where there's others who see him as a devotee and encourage him in his service. And he's a completely different person to them. So, you will have these opportunities. Oh, get out of my, get out of my way, demon. Well, you're not going to bring the best out of the person by that attitude. And also, you know, if there's something wrong in a relationship, you know, we take a look at, well, what have I done to contribute to this? The other thing I like is, I used to raise and train mules. You never saw my mules, did you? Yeah. Now, mules are interesting because they have a reputation of being the most stubborn animal, stubborn as a mule. Any mule deer or mule skinner means they know that that animal, more than any, will lay down their life for you. Well, that appears to be highly contradictory. So I wrote out a checklist for mule trainers. What it means if a mule is being stubborn. If a mule is being stubborn, the first thing it's likely to mean is you are acting like an ass. Not the mule. The man. Number two is there's something lacking in our relationship. Number three is you're not communicating adequately. Number four is you're not giving me the whole picture or even enough of a fraction of the whole picture that I can have faith in, you know, what you're asking me to do. So that dumb beast becomes our teacher. And training animals is a great way to train devotees. Because if you're angry or upset or seeing them as some dumb beast, that's exactly what you're going to get. But if you see them, you know, what a precious gift, that's what you're going to get. So, you know, our thoughts and attitudes tremendously affect even material nature, what to speak of devotees' attitudes and behaviors. So when there's something deficient in a relationship, take a good portion of the responsibility yourself, even if you don't deserve it, and see how that helps. Or, as Bhaktivedanta Maharaj, you know, frequently said, you can see, you know, hurt behavior is either an expression of love or a call for love. And, you know, love is the most powerful force in redeeming and rectifying that there is. So we just have to, you know, cultivate more and more of it in our hearts. All right. Anything else? Thank you very, very much. All glorious to Srila Prabhupada.